You're listening to The Martial Brain, the podcast that explores the intersection between the martial arts, science, critical thinking, skepticism, and that wacky organ that floats inside our skull in a pool of cerebrospinal fluid, making life unpredictably inspiring, infuriating, and sometimes just batshit crazy. I'm Jeff Westfall for The Martial Brain. Martial arts or martial science? Or how to train the barely evolved martial monkey? To me, part of what keeps the martial arts from being purely martial science stems directly from what this podcast is all about. The intersection of the martial arts and the continually surprising oddities of human behavior that stem, no pun intended, from our far-from-perfect brains. Humans make choices in all kinds of situations that don't pass the smell test of logic and reason. To me, part of the art in martial arts comes from developing creative methods of adapting to the quirky antics of students, instructors, training partners, and opponents. The quirky behavior of students can take many forms. One typical form of human behavior is hierarchical thinking. When it comes to the martial arts, that means being concerned with who is the best. Who is the best student? Who is the best teacher? Who is the best fighter? What is the best style? This way of thinking can lead to trouble when a student has established in his mind his place in the hierarchy, and then a talented new student joins the academy and learns at a fast enough pace that he eventually passes up the first student in the hierarchy, at least in the mind of the first student, much to his disappointment or even despair. This type of thinking has caused more than one promising student to drop out of martial arts training altogether. Another form of quirky student behavior is misplaced skepticism. The process of teaching the martial arts student is already slowed down by any number of factors without adding additional delays. One common delay is skepticism on the part of the student when it comes to new techniques. Now, anyone who knows me knows that I am a huge fan of skepticism. But a martial arts academy is not a debating forum. There is a particular subspecies of student that when you present new material wants you to spend time proving to him or her that the technique in question is worth spending time to develop. If you will recall, I did an earlier episode of this podcast encouraging the student to ask questions of his instructor. I absolutely still believe this to be true. However, when you pay an instructor for lessons, you are, in my opinion, entering into a contract with him or her that you already buy into the program that he or she is offering. Your questions should be more about how or when to execute a technique, not about whether it is worth learning. This problem has a paradoxical form similar to the one that goes, "No one will hire me unless I have experience. How do I gain experience unless someone hires me?" In the same vein, it's hard to trust a martial arts technique until you feel confident with it. But confidence only comes after repetition and training. Extensive repetition requires serious motivation. From where do you get the motivation to do the extensive practicing? The answer is simple. From the trust you have in your instructor and his or her curriculum. No matter how strange a technique may at first feel, trust your instructor's judgment. Shut up and practice the technique, or go elsewhere and put your trust in a different instructor. A third particularly human quirk of many martial arts students is self-doubt. A common scene in a martial arts class unfolds like this. The student is working through repetitions of a technique, then pauses, shakes his head, and complains, "It doesn't feel right." After checking to make sure the student is not injuring himself, I ask, "Have you tried to learn this technique before?" When the student answers with no, I respond with, "Then how do you expect at this point to already know what the technique is supposed to feel like?" Frequently, upon digging deeper, I find that what the student actually means is that the technique doesn't feel as smooth and easy as it appears when I or another instructor demonstrates it. I then explained that a sense of ease and fluidity is usually only developed through repetition, and not from some pithy advice offered by the instructor. I also find that in cases like this, it's important to follow up with the student. Behavior like this frequently comes from a lack of self-confidence. He or she is likely to repeat the behavior. Such students find it hard to believe that they will ever be able to execute the technique at anything like a decent level of competence, even after they are already executing it, in your opinion, maybe even fairly well. Quirky behavior manifests not only in students, but in instructors as well. Now, you would think that this would not be a problem, since the instructor is the professional martial artist, and should by now have a handle on his or her behavior. Experience has taught me and many others, however, that this is not always the case. I'm going to thoroughly cover the different types of quirky instructors in a future edition of this podcast, so I'll just give you a cursory sketch here. The spectrum runs from perfect at one end, through eccentric, temperamental, jealous, manipulative, arrogant, abusive, all the way to full-on diagnosable delusional nut job. It can be useful to do an improvised cost-benefit analysis, balancing the value of what knowledge the instructor has to offer against the amount of grief and irritation one must endure to learn it. Now we come to quirkiness in training partners. I'm fond of saying that a good training partner is more rare than the rarest of gems. Take good care of him once you have found him. Compliment his technique. Buy him dinner. Get him laid. Do what it takes, because you may never get another good training partner again. As a matter of fact, good training partners can be so hard to come by that it's wise to overlook minor personality quirks and idiosyncrasies. Don't sweat the small stuff. One potential significant conflict which may arise between you and your training partner could be a difference in your respective approaches to training. One of the most typical disagreements is over what I call the ratio of work to play. Here, by play, I mean sparring, rolling, rondori, bouting, or whatever you call free fighting practice. I don't mean the word play in a derogatory way. Play is important in training, and I will discuss it in depth in a future podcast. Where the problem crops up is when your partner wants only to play. While I believe sparring, in one form or another, to be extremely important, a desire to spend nearly all your training time sparring shows at best a poor understanding of why we train, and at worst, profound laziness. Unfortunately, not all training is fun. There are any number of important training drills and methods closer to the work end of the spectrum that require another warm body and functioning brain to do. Your game will grow far faster if you and your partner pursue a judicious mix of work and play. And finally, we come to the last category of irrational people that draw out the art in martial pursuits. The category without which there would be no need for the martial arts. Opponents. Opponents are notorious for doing what you don't want or expect them to do. That's why they call them opponents. These unexpected behaviors can be either the result of rational, calculated tactical choice, or wackaloon, irrational, barely evolved monkeys in shoes mental processes. Of course, one of the most rational tactics is to momentarily appear to do something irrational. Therefore, what appears to be an easy opportunity might be a lure to draw you in. It's wise to employ footwork, feints, and false attacks to gain information about the opponent's tendencies, to draw responses, always being ready for irrational as well as rational actions. A potentially dangerous form of common behavior is what I call the two-minute Hercules. Similar to what the Vikings called berserkergang, this is when the opponent goes ballistic, throwing caution to the wind and attacking like a madman. When this happens, you must react quickly, but with icy calm. Trying to match the opponent's intensity is a fool's game, and a poor use of your hard-won skills and conditioning. If your opponent wants to exert tremendous energy early in a fight, indulge him intelligently. This is where grappling and or clinching skills can really come in handy. Nothing works better to exhaust the 2-minute Hercules. It's amazing what a few minutes of emptying his gas tank does to the berserker. Done properly, this leaves him in a state of near docile exhaustion. Another behavior is what I call the crowder. This opponent is not to be confused with a well-trained grappler who is trying to shoot in for a tackle. Instead, this is a fear-induced behavior that stems from a frantic desire to get inside the opponent's strikes, combined with not knowing how to fight properly on the inside once you get there. He or she moves towards you while trying to strike, but actually overruns the proper distance, jamming up both you and himself. Despite being a less than efficient strategy, this type of behavior can be awkward for your own game, especially if the rules exclude grappling or the clinch. If that is the case, the infighting skills of boxing will be invaluable. Another quirky behavior of some opponents is to consistently move away from you without trying much of anything as a counterattack. I call this subspecies the runner, as do many other people. If you are engaged in a self-defense encounter with the runner, the solution is quite simple. Leave. There's nothing to defend yourself against. If you're sparring, options would include discussing your partner's behavior with him, or using the situation as an opportunity to use footwork to cut off the opponent's escape routes, or baiting the opponent into attacking by leaving openings in your defense and then countering when he takes the bait and attacks. If you're in competition, first be careful that the behavior is not a ploy to set you up. Then try cutting off the ring or baiting your opponent. In the final analysis, the most dangerous of opponents is highly skilled, coldly calculating, and utterly unpredictable, able to employ whatever tactics are necessary to win. Assuming that we are not discussing self-defense, if you lose to such an opponent, shake his or her hand and express gratitude for the honor of competing against them. If, however, you lose to someone because their irrational behavior caught you flat-footed and unprepared, still shake his or her hand, while inside the privacy of your thoughts, kick yourself for a rookie mistake. Anyway, that's what I think. But I could be wrong. Let me know what you think at my website, rpmartialarts.com. I'm Jeff Westfall for The Martial Brain. The Martial Brain is produced by Raging Squirrel Productions in association with the Rising Phoenix Martial Arts Academy. If you like the podcast and would like to help it grow, go to iTunes or Stitcher and give it an honest rating and review. Contact me with questions about the Martial Brain or the Rising Phoenix Academy at our website, rpmartialarts.com.